because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Great today to have David Arsenault Jr. with us. Coach Arsenault is a head coach at Grinnell College and started as head coach there in 2017 and previously was a G League head coach for Reno. And we'll talk about all those things. But first off, Coach, welcome to the podcast. And we're excited to dive into some system basketball today.
Yeah, you know what? It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on. Excited to talk about the system as well.
Well, and of course, your dad, David Arsenault Sr., made the system famous at Grinnell as well. And we have a chance here today to talk in depth about it and dissect it a little bit. But let's first, for those that aren't as familiar with it, just give us a brief overview of what the system is.
So the best way that I could describe it would be to imagine if your team is down by 8 points with about a minute and 20 seconds left and how you're going to have to play the game at that point in the contest. And then while we do foul quite a bit, try to remove the intentional fouling. And essentially, that's how we try to play for all 40 minutes. So we're pressing, we're gambling, we're going for steals on offense every single time, whether it's a live ball or a referee handle. We're racing the ball down the court and trying to get the first available shot, preferably a three-point shot, but we will take shots at the rim as well. And then when you extend that over 40 minutes, what ends up happening is we end up rotating groups of five on and off the floor. Usually it turns out to be about a minute. It is the first whistle after 35 seconds. And so in some ways it resembles hockey as well, but that's the best way that I can describe it. And then I guess most importantly, we just try to have fun and try to play quick, try to have fun, try to take some pressure off the guys by just playing up tempo style.
Well, and it's great. And that was the first part that I would think about is that it's fun. It's got to be fun to play. And it's got to be fun to a certain extent to recruit to. Although, are there challenges to recruit players to a system where there would be sort of equal playing time and less opportunity to be a star if you thought you were a star?
Yeah, you know, every once in a while it becomes a little bit challenging recruiting. We had a kid 2 years ago who led the country in scoring, averaged just over 33 points a game. And you know, he only played 19 minutes a game. And so certainly when you're recruiting players out of high school and they maybe come from a situation where they're used to playing the entire game or all but a few minutes of the game, when they first look at our season box score or they hear about our substitution pattern, it can be a little bit eye-opening for some and it requires them to think outside the box. And I recognize that that's not for everybody, but of course, there are advantages. We play a ton of guys in our rotation. We play 16, 17 guys. There are always about 10 to 12 guys that are getting double-digit minutes. So it's a place where a lot of guys can play and a lot of guys can play early in their career.
And the player development part we'll get into. How many players would you end up playing in a game? Does the full roster play? Or when you talk about hockey shifts, is it generally 10 players? That's where it goes back and forth, platooning five on, five off?
It really varies by the year with kind of how deep we are. So we have 20 uniforms. We dress 20 for all of our games. Unfortunately, creative limits don't usually allow me to play all 20 on a consistent basis. It generally turns out to be 16, 17, maybe 18 guys. On some years, we've rotated three groups of five, generally in equal shifts. I would say that at the start of all games, we take the participation angle. And so we're trying to get as many guys into the game early on as possible. And then as the game progresses late in the first half is when we usually condense down to what we call our AB, which is our top 10. Doesn't necessarily mean that shift A is better than shift B. It's more so just a collection of our top 10 players. And then we open up the second half the same way with the participation angle, start condensing down usually around the 10 to 8 minute mark. And then as the game progresses even further, we're trying to ignore the scoreboard as much as possible. But certainly at the end of the day, we want to try to come away with a win as well. And so then later on in games, depending on the score, we'll even condense down to what we call our finishing groups, which is our last five players. And so from day one of practice, I'm telling our guys that your goal should not be to start the game because we're going to have 20 different guys probably start a game over the course of the season. The goal should be, you want to get into that finishing group if that's what your dreams are. To be in that finishing group means that you're one of our best five players, that you're on the floor at the end of the game when the game could potentially be on the line.
So I know one of the knocks I
hear about the system is, well, you don't win enough. And to be clear, you guys win games. It's not like you lose all your games. But whenever I hear that, I immediately turn to the person that says it and says, well, wait a minute. What is sport about? Is it not about student experience? And then secondly, at your level and the level that I coached at, it's about student recruitment for the university as well. So you're bringing 20 students to the university, and that matters too. So saying all that, forget about the winning angle. Do you have administrative support that at the end of the day, you know, winning matters, but they see the bigger picture of all this as well?
Yeah, so we're a Division III school located in central Iowa. And, you know, for us, it is, first and foremost, it's about the student athlete experience. And I also look at it from a perspective of where would we be if we weren't playing this style? And when my dad first created it, and he started in 1989 at Grinnell, and the program was really not in good shape. And that's not to belittle the players that were here before them. It's just that the reality of the situation was the program hadn't had a winning season in about 30 years. And to watch the evolution of our style of play and how it's changed over the years has been fascinating. And then even still, when I think about what we're doing, like, we're not going to be competing for a Division III national title next year. That's just not in the cards for us. But when I think about what would happen if we weren't playing this style, and we're just in a much better place because of our system, because it is an equalizer of sorts. It gives us chances against teams that maybe are just bigger than us, maybe are just more physical, maybe have a dominant inside presence that we just would not be able to match up with in a half-court game. And it creates a lot more variance. Obviously, if you're taking 55 to 63-point shot attempts per game, the variance associated on an individual game can be quite high. And so in a lot of ways, I look at it as what would be the result if we weren't going with this. In every single season, it seems like we have just a better chance playing this way. This past season, we went 19-6. We tied a school record for wins. We finished second in our league. And if we tried to match up with teams in a half court, kind of more conventional game, I am 100% positive that we would not have been 19-6. You know, so while we're still trying to build and get better with each passing year and see if we can win our league, see if we can make it to the NCAA tournament. You know, those are the gradual steps that we're trying to take with our program.
Well, it's outstanding. It's a great philosophy for people
to consider, especially at some different types of challenges that we coach at different schools, different locations, whatever level we coach at. But the other part that I want people to understand is nobody would have heard of your school to a certain extent outside of a general radius unless this system existed. Because think about worldwide, I'm sure you get people reaching out to you that have heard of Grinnell because of this. And that's pretty cool and pretty impressive as well.
Oh, it's awesome. We have I have high school coaches specifically that are reaching out all the time, especially in situations where parents want to see their kids play and parents are more involved in the process. Like, it's a great way to distribute the playing time, to get a lot of kids in the game, to create an energy and excitement around your program. I always, on a consistent basis, I'm thinking back to something that I've heard my dad say over and over again, which was just that, you know, if you have a team that has consistently struggled, it can really just not be a fun experience to be a part of that. And his rationale when he first went to it was his teams were inevitably going to lose. And rather than lose 60-40, was there a way for him to get it so that they were at least scoring 120 points in the process? And that way there was something positive to talk about and somebody was scoring those points. A lot of guys were playing, a lot of guys were taking shots. And that's always a reminder that I try to instill in my teams and to think about how far we've come. There is an expectation within our program that we're going to have a winning record now, that we want to be qualifying for our conference tournament. We want to make a run at conference titles now. And it's just a friendly reminder for me to keep things in perspective about why this system was created and why it started.
Well, it's great. It's great that you can balance
this philosophy of style of play with a competitive philosophy as well. Because at the end of the day, you're a competitor and your players are competitors. So they want to try and compete and win. So it's great that this is giving them the opportunity while they're still having a great experience. Now, the other question that I'm sure you get asked a lot is there a balance between this and just taking parts of what you do to be able to add it to someone else's system? Say they're not all in on the defensive philosophy, or say they're not all in on certain things. Is there a balance that you found that someone's successful with this, taking bits and pieces?
I certainly think there is. you know, a lot of coaches have said to me, hey, you know what, I want to do what you guys do offensively, and we want to take a lot of threes, and we want to play up tempo, but we don't want to give up the easy shots at the other end. And I would agree with that. I would prefer to not give up on contested layups as well, but the reality is that just becomes very, very challenging when you take a look at all the parts. So there are certainly aspects that people take, whether it's the shot selection, whether it's the pace that we're trying to play with. And every coach that ends up implementing this style of play, you have to tweak it. You have to tweak it to your personnel. You have to tweak it to your situation. You have to tweak it to maybe the brand of basketball that's played in your conference or that's played in your state or that's played in your country, and adjust it to what is going to work for you. So it's always a trial and error. I think that it actually probably does Grinnell College specifically a little bit of a disservice to think that the way that my dad was running it back in the mid-90s is at all resembling the way that we run it now, just because it is so different with even how we – now, there are some tenets that are the same. You know, we're still trying to play with a 12-second shot clock, and we're still trying to maximize three-point shots and maximize player participation. But there are a lot of things that have evolved over the years, and there are a lot of ways that other teams have evolved over the years as well, and just the general direction of basketball has made it very different from even how we were playing 5 years ago.
Well, of course. I mean, good coaches and good programs evolve and they adapt, and we'll dive into that a little bit. Let's start with some of the specifics of the system. So maybe let's talk about preferred playmaker. What's the role of the preferred playmaker?
So with how we end up recruiting at Grinnell, we end up getting one, two, three guys maybe that are, by and large, more gifted athletes, better scorers in our program. And when we're thinking about our offense, it's not really an equal piece of the pie offense. I had a chance to speak quite a bit with Vance Wahlberg, creator of the Dribble Drive offense, when I was working for the Sacramento Kings organization, and he was on staff with George Karl with the Kings. And you know, my understanding of that is that it becomes a little bit more of a five guys or at least four guys on the perimeter that are all able to attack. And that's not really what we do. What we try to do is we try to keep the ball in the hands of our preferred playmaker, our best player in the group, as much as possible. And we rely on that player to make 90% of the decision. And so generally speaking, that's a player that can create his own shot and really forces the issue on the other team. Do they want to send help and bring a double team? Or if not, then that player is going to just be able to generate a quick shot for themselves. And if they do, then we surround that player with shooters or a slip cutter or somebody around the rim so that it becomes an easier inside out pass to the 3-point line for an open shot or a dump off pass to somebody around the rim. And so when I start structuring our groups and who's going to play together, we start with our preferred playmaker. And that doesn't necessarily mean that person has to be a point guard. It can really be any position on the floor. We just want to figure out a way to, within 12 seconds, get the basketball, get that player at least two cracks with the basketball in a situation where they can either create their own shot or draw a double team. You know, and everything else dominoes off that. We have set transition lanes that we're looking to run. So we're looking to spread the floor as wide as possible, giving our point guard the middle third of the floor to play with and to be creative. And then after that, once we actually get in, if we don't get an initial shot, what we're thinking about is where does our preferred playmaker like to play from and how can we just get them the basketball in that spot quickly and let them kind of go to work, so to speak. So for us, everything has been predicated on having a guy in each group that can really dominate the basketball and can make things happen for our offense each and every time down the floor.
Well, it's great, and it's a great analogy to the
dribble drive in the sense that you want a player that has a matchup all the time, basically, and can drive their matchup and create. And either score or kick out is obviously the goal there. So then you also have a scorer on each lineup. Is it a designated player that is the primary look? Is that what you mean by having a scorer on each platoon?
So our preferred playmaker, we use that. They could be a scorer, but they're also somebody that we just want to have. And so it's actually the same person generally. And so our preferred playmaker, we label them as that as opposed to a preferred scorer, because we want that player to have the recognition that, hey, if you do draw a double team, there's no sense in forcing a shot through a double team. That just means that somebody else on the floor is open. And so it used to be the preferred scorer is what we called it. We've kind of just evolved, really just changing the name of the player, not necessarily that we want them to play any differently, but more so just to create an environment where that player doesn't necessarily feel like they have to score or take every single shot down the floor, that they can actually just play within the flow of the game. And a lot of times teams will dictate how that preferred playmaker stat line and what that preferred playmaker stat line looks like. You know, and then as the shot clock winds down, which means that it's gotten past 12 seconds off the shot clock, that preferred playmaker at that point, then they have to generate a shot. And a lot of times that might not necessarily be a great shot, but they have to generate a shot just so that we can get the pace going back up and down. And it always amazes me the amount of times when we set a 12-second shot clock in practice situations or in live scrimmage situations, it amazes me that when guys are just thinking that we have to get a shot up rather than we have to make a shot, it amazes me how many times those quote-unquote bad shots will actually just go in because they're not thinking about whether they have to make it or miss it.
So every coach has to spend a lot of time defining roles.
Is there more of those conversations within your program to be able to continually define roles? You've talked about obviously preferred playmaker. You've talked about A and B. You've talked about playing 20 players. So is there, like, you've been in a lot of different coaching experience. Is there more of those conversations within what you do?
Yeah, there really is. And that's actually one of the things that when other teams go to our style, I see end up affecting kind of their shooting percentages the most is when they don't have those conversations, or it turns almost into a little bit of a free-for-all. Certainly, just like every other team probably in the country, we want our best shooters and best playmakers making the majority of the plays, and we want to get the ball in their hands. But, you know, there are those conversations, and the guys need to recognize, you know, where do they fall in the pecking order? And it can be difficult conversations at times because, of course, everybody probably wants to be in that preferred playmaking role. And having trust in the process and having trust in their teammates and finding those roles becomes incredibly important. I think back to a guy that I played with, and I won't say him by name, but this guy was, I don't know if you would consider him a college-level basketball player, but he was incredibly successful in our system in the sense that he didn't ever want to touch the basketball. He was really comfortable screening and offensive rebounding and defending. And if the ball was on one side of the floor, he would not be there with his hands up looking for the ball. He would be running to the other side of the floor, essentially just creating space for some more talented players on the court to be able to make plays. And so it's fascinating to me every year how some guys that maybe you would not consider to be, or I would not consider to be, college level basketball players can really impact the game for us just with their IQ, with their spacing, with understanding the.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me how role players can take such great, and they can just be so important to our team with when we have a preferred playmaker in a particular group, having somebody that is buying into the role of spacing the floor or defending or screening or offensive rebounding. It doesn't need the basketball in their hands. That can be incredibly important, especially with the way that we play, because it can just make a group go and it can make a group hum. And if you have too many guys in one particular group that need the basketball in their hands, things can get bogged down. Things can get slow. The spacing all of a sudden gets thrown off. And for me, honestly, that was one of the biggest challenges when I was in the G League, was that all of those guys in the G League, it's probably one of the only leagues in the world where nobody really wants to be in the G League. And they're thinking about, how do they get the call up to the NBA? They're thinking about, is there a way for them to position themselves to make more money potentially overseas? And so one of the biggest challenges for me was, how are we going to adjust this style from what I had known at Grinnell with a preferred playmaker to something that is going to be a little bit more of a piece at the pie, because everybody on the court needed to touch the ball.
Well, those are interesting conversations.
I want to come back to the G League a little bit, but the point that you said about being able to find a role for a player, which again, if you talk about high school level and youth level, you're talking about increasing a player's satisfaction and experience because they have a set role. And part of that is true, like especially in a high school situation where you don't get to recruit your players. I mean, you have football players, you have basketball players, you have really good basketball players, and you have guys that are just playing for participation reasons. So your system makes sense in that sense. And as you said, at the Division III level, that's even more apparent. So in terms of some of those conversations that you have, and kind of coming back to it, is there a variation in style from one platoon to the next? Like you talk about, if you look at an NBA situation, you say, okay, if Russell Westbrook's on the floor, we can do this. But if he's not, then Oklahoma City has to do something completely different. Is that the case for you with your different preferred playmakers on each shift, or is it essentially the same system for both?
So there are many of the same principles for both, and that's going to be our transition lanes. That's going to be the shot selection that we're looking for. So 1A is going to be an inside-out three-point shot. 1B is going to be a shot at the rim, and then 2 or 3, depending on how you want to number it, is going to be either a lateral pass three-point shot or an off-the-dribble three-point shot. So those are what I would call the non-negotiables within our system. And then how we structure that and how we create that shot within each group can be very, very different. And just to give a couple examples, maybe from this past year, we had a first-team all-conference player that was a 6'5 point guard with really Division I caliber athleticism. And he really operated from that mid-post, low to mid-post area. So he would come down the floor and he would look to create a quick shot either for himself or for a teammate. And then if the first pass did not lead to a shot, what he would actually do was he would slide into that mid-post area. We would get him the basketball back there. And he usually had a size advantage where he could post up a smaller guard. And it was just another way for us to get the ball into the teeth of the defense. If he could score from that position, that was great. If not, we knew that there was going to be some type of help side defense coming and he would be able to kick it out to another shooter. In the second group, we had a player that was really a lights out shooter and had range that extended well beyond the 3-point line. And so with him, we actually got him a touch at the arc someplace, sometimes from basically the NBA line, and we had him squaring up and trying to create. He had good size. He was 6'7" shooting guard, basically. And we would have him catch it at the arc, square up. He could create a 3-point shot for himself, either by using a jab step, putting the ball to the floor, taking one dribble to try to pull up still from the 3-point line, either way. So it was two groups that had the same goals in mind in terms of how we were going to create a quick shot, but that were playing from very different positions. And so every season is new in the sense that we take a look at who our preferred playmakers are going to be and where on the court that they are best from. In a lot of cases, I'll ask them, you know, where are you most comfortable? Do you just need space? Do you need a ball screen from the arc? Is it maybe from the mid post? Which side of the floor do you like to get the basketball on? Like, those are conversations that I'll have with our top end players so that then we can structure the rest of our offense around getting the basketball to those players in those positions. And like I said, it can change every single year. So while we still have the same transition lanes that we're running, we're still looking for the same shot selection. We're still trying to play with a 12-second shot clock. It can really vary year to year based on our personnel, where guys are going to be getting the ball from.
Yeah, it's great. It's great that there's, again, no
surprise. All good coaches do this, but there's adaptability and flexibility within the system, and that's perfect. And another curious question, Coach, but even people that discount this system in some way, and there's coaches that discount all systems, so it's probably a compliment that they've given it thought in any way, but let's think about what is the one thing or two things that coaches are missing or that they could be stealing from this system or style of play that you kind of say, why is everyone not doing this particular part of it? Is there something that you can point to?
So I think that offensively, one of the biggest things for us is at least what I see other programs doing. And so everybody would like to score in transition. And most coaches look at that as off of a defensive rebound or live turnover. Here's how we're going to score in transition. And we do that as well. The area, we just also try to create transition opportunities after the other team has scored. And it's always struck me as a little bit odd as to why more coaches don't do that. There's a natural tendency when a team scores for them to relax just for a split second. And especially if there's a spread floor, we're basically trying every single time that we get scored on, rather than hang our heads or identify who screwed up or whatever that I see so many teams do, we're just trying to get the basketball out of the net before it hits the ground, inbound it to our point guard, take off the other way, and see if at that point we can actually trade baskets. And for us at Grinnell, for myself and my team in the G League, that was the area that I think separates our offense the most and can just, if we can generate transition opportunities after the other team scores with the spread floor by trading baskets, that is one area that I think everybody can separate themselves. And yes, we do not like giving up baskets, and we'll try to correct some of those things in film sessions or after the game, after the fact, but in the moment, trying to get our guys to understand that something bad may have just occurred against our team in the sense of the other team scoring. Is there a way for us to just capitalize on them relaxing a little bit, or the spacing of the floor, or turn that into a transition opportunity?
Well, it's a present focus offense for sure. Like, the immediacy of it
is awesome. And that's a great point that all coaches could adhere to. Is there much game planning or scouting reports going on? Like your system really doesn't change that much depending on who you're playing. You're trying to dictate your will to them. But are you doing much scouting reports in terms of personnel or opponent actions?
Dave Smart is one of the best coaches in the world, and now you can learn from him with never-before-available access. 3 all-access practices and 1 defensive coaching clinic are available at davesmartbasketball.com. What makes these all-access practice and clinic videos so unique? Dave Smart has won 12 national championships and has a winning percentage of 92%. Dave Smart's force weak hand defensive system is world-renowned and has never been shared in this way before. Dave Smart has a winning record in over 50 games versus NCAA Division I teams, having beaten Wichita State, Baylor, Wisconsin, and many others. Dave Smart is recognized by Jay Wright, Mick Cronin, Jay Triano, and many other top coaches in the world as one of the best minds in basketball. Learn from one of the greatest minds in the game, who opened his doors and shared the game with us from one of the most successful basketball programs in the world. Go to davesmartbasketball.com now to learn more and to purchase all 4 videos.
So in terms of like their half court sets, no, because another team will never run a half court set against us unless it's in the final couple minutes of the game. And at that point, hopefully we have enough points to win once we do kind of back off the press. So it has saved me so much time from a scouting perspective. To be honest, I can tell you every other team's press breaker, and a lot of times if the coaches stay the same, they'll run a very similar press breaker year after year, because when they look at us on the schedule, it's almost like, I'm not to say they're not taking us seriously, but it's almost like a blip on their schedule that they have to adjust everything that they want to do. And so from a scouting perspective, what we'll talk about in the days leading up to a game is what is their press breaker, maybe identify a couple of their players, what they like to do. If they have a guard that is a great passer, we'll talk about, hey, a 2-on-1, 3-on-1 situations, we have to identify how we want to play this. This guy is likely looking to dump off. So can we adjust kind of our mentality on that? Maybe if another team wants to spot up a shooter, we'll talk about, hey, this is somebody we have to run back wide and transition. We have to get out to the arc on this player and run them off the line. But when I'm thinking about the amount of hours that coaches spend scouting and game planning and everything, it can just be an excruciating process. I know some coaches really love that, trying to find chinks in the other team's armor. But for me, it's more that I can focus on my own guys. I can focus on what we're doing. I can review. It's much more beneficial for me to review our last game against any opponent for our upcoming game than it is for me to actually watch any game film of 2 other teams playing. And so I think that that's just helped me coach my own guys, get them in a position to play, get for us to get better at what we're doing, and in the process just save so much time for myself.
Well, it's an underrated part of pressing, right? That you don't have to focus as much on the other team's half-court offense because, as you said, they're never going to run it. So I think that's a brilliant part of it, especially at a level like you're coaching at. So another part that goes with that then, how much in-game adjustments can you really make? Are you able to make in-game adjustments?
It's hard. I can tell you that it's hard. That my seat on the bench is down on the corner of the sideline baseline. So when we're subbing so many guys, I kind of found that if I sit up at the front of the bench, there are constantly 5 guys that are just walking past me, getting in the way. And so I put my chair down there on the corner of the baseline, try to sit back as much as possible. And the other thing is that we're just playing so fast that there are going to be hundreds of mistakes that are made throughout the game. In a lot of cases, I feel like if I can't see them happening when they're live, then chances are that not a lot of people are going to be seeing them when they're happening live. And so on game nights, while there are some adjustments that all coaches are trying to make, I'm generally focused on kind of spacing issues. I'm generally focused on maybe how teams are trying to defend us and different wrinkles that they're putting into place. But in a lot of cases, there might not be all that many adjustments with what we're doing, you know? And so I think that that's relaxing and refreshing for our guys to know that, hey, on game night, you've earned your playing time. We're not going to make substitutions based on fouls. We're not going to make wholesale substitutions to our style of play. We might make adjustments in between games, but generally speaking, on game night, it's about letting the players go out there and play and living with the result that occurs.
Yeah, no, and great. And that's part of what coaching should be to a certain extent, too. And on game day, your players get to play without the guidance of the coach because you've done your job in practice and in preparation, getting them ready to play. So they have a certain freedom that goes with that. So it's really good stuff. So let's circle back to the G League a little bit because I want to make sure we get to that. So what were some of your takeaways about this offense in particular in the G League?
So when I first got hired, I had no idea really and truly how it was going to work and how we were going to adapt it to the G League, right? Like I've come from a Division III school with a certain caliber of athlete where the reason that kids are coming to Grinnell first and foremost is for the academic reasons. And then going to a situation where it's a professional organization where the focus is on basketball, it was an adjustment. So I went in with the idea and was given the blessing to kind of run it how I wanted and experiment, which I worked very closely with Dean Oliver, who's written a number of basketball statistical analysis books, papers, articles, is really at the forefront of the advanced statistics that are used in the game of basketball, especially at a professional level. And so it was a process that the first year in the G League, I think we finished with a 20-30 record. I went in there and I just decided, you know, the best way to start is let's start with what I know, which is how to run the Grinnell system. And so we started with that. And very early on, I realized that we were going to have to make some adjustments because we only had a 10-man roster and guys were coming in and out of the program. And we probably ended up with about 30 different players over the course of the year, just with guys that were leaving, that were signing other deals, that were getting called up to the NBA, that were going overseas. Different transactions that we made where we might want to add another player so that we were going to have to modify certainly our substitution pattern. I can even think back to a game where we were on the road and, you know, one guy tweaked his ankle early on and all of a sudden we were down to 9 guys, you know? And so the idea of platooning or rotating 3 groups of 5 was never an option. And so how are we going to modify and adjust or what could still work and what couldn't work? And then I touched earlier a little bit on the preferred maker. Well, all of the guys that were on my roster, really and truly, there was nobody that was just going to feel comfortable or be happy just being on the court if they were never touching the basketball. And so we tried to modify how are we going to structure our offense when a pass is made. We're not necessarily just throwing it right back to our preferred playmaker. We need to space the floor a little bit so that we can give that player an opportunity to look to put the ball on the floor in attack as well. And so over the 2 years that I was with the Reno Bighorns, we modified, we adjusted, we created what was a little bit more of an equal piece of the pie. I would say that it was a hybrid between the Grinnell system and maybe what the dribble drive offense looks like. There was a ton of ball screen opportunities. And again, really just looking to space the floor and try to play up tempo still with a 12-second shot clock, with inside out 3-point shots, but certainly a number of modifications that we made.
Again, fascinating thought experiment. And obviously you had organizational support to try it and seemed like a lot of really positive things came from it. And again, to a certain amount, it's justified because of the way that teams are progressively playing in the NBA nowadays too. So I'm curious too, are there some teams that are unwatchable for you? And you don't have to say the names, but having coached in the FIBA game for so long, for example, there's some NCAA teams that are unwatchable for me because, and not because it's not enjoyable, all basketball is enjoyable, but because the style is so different than how we play that it doesn't translate as much. Is that the case for you after having coached this system for so long?
Yeah, I would say that it's not that anybody's unwatchable, but I'll just find myself consistently encouraging teams to push the pace or saying shoot it a lot, you know, when I'm watching the game.
Yeah.
Even I find myself saying that, like, oh man, they passed up that look. But I understand it. I think it's just a testament to the number of different ways that the game can be played. I mean, even when you look at the NCAA Division I Final Four this year, and the two teams that were playing in the national championship game, like, they were grinded out defensive teams. Texas Tech running their motion offense, Virginia obviously being very, very patient, and those two teams playing for the national title. So it's always a reminder to me that there are just so many different ways to play the game, that each coach, you know, and obviously the two coaches in that game did a tremendous job with their team to get them to that point, but that there are just so many different ways to play the game. It really is what makes it the best game on the planet. You know, the number of variations that you can see across the board at all levels is quite fascinating.
It is so fascinating, for sure. But I do agree with you. I mean, and I think eventually it'll adjust, but just the fact that open shots aren't taken is kind of frustrating to watch because you know how hard it is to get open shots in a system like yours, and you're playing with incredible pace. So how much harder is it if you're not playing with pace and you're not trying to take the first available good look for a player that can make it? And it just seems to consistently be there.
Well, and I think specifically, like, the confidence in shooters, and that's something that we try to build from day one in our practice situations. We have a chart on the wall, and one of the first things we do at practice is everybody on our roster takes 100 three-point shots. And so we have spots on the floor that we'd like to shoot from. We have certain ways that we want the guys to pass the basketball to the shooter. We chart them, and so it's on a wall so the guys can see their progression over the season. And really and truly, what we're doing with it, it takes us 18 minutes on the dot to get it done. What we're trying to do in that time slot is build confidence in our shooters. So we're trying to give them the easiest possible three-point shot with no other distractions, in an effort to increase the number of times they're going to see the basketball go through the hoop. And I'll often see guys that have worked all year long for any program on their outside shot, and they come back into a new season with this newfound confidence in their outside shot. And the amount of damage a coach, that myself, that any coach could do with their body language the first time a player misses one of those shots is, it's just an incredible amount of damage that can be done. You know, if the shoulders dip, or if somebody's being negatively substituted right away, I just feel like all that work that a player has done over the course of a season has, over the course of the offseason, can just be totally ripped away from them. And for us, yes, we want our best shooters obviously shooting the basketball, but I try to be very, very careful with what my body language is, what my reaction is when maybe a player takes a shot that is not the shot that we want. And is there a way for me to delicately frame it so that I'm not destroying somebody's confidence? Because at the end of the day, players are going to make mistakes. And I know that all coaches like to have a lot of control over everything that's going on, but is there a way for myself to adjust my mentality and adjust how I'm coaching the guys so that I'm not hurting their confidence? I'm maybe just trying to guide them into the preferred shot that we would like to take.
Yeah, it's great. And that player development
component's got to be a part of this too. It's got to be a fun way to practice. And with your practice style, do you guys primarily practice? Do you practice on air? Do you practice live 5-on-5? How do your practices evolve?
Yeah, we do a ton of 5-on-0 stuff. 5-on-0 skeleton. Each day at the beginning of the season, we're kind of focused on something a little bit different, whether it's, hey, you know what? Here's how we're going to attack after the other team scores against us. Hey, here's the transition lanes that we're going to run if it's a live turnover or defensive rebound. And just a lot of 5-on-0 stuff, trying to find groups and different combinations of players that work, that play well together, that understand where the other person is going to be on the floor in terms of their spacing, that maybe bring unique combinations of skill sets and blend them together so that we're going to hopefully get maximal production out of a unit of five. But a ton of 5-on-0 stuff, and just getting guys comfortable going at that speed, going at that pace, not worried about the defense, running our stuff how we want to run it and not letting the defense overly dictate what we're going to try to do.
And then when do you introduce the defense to that? And I should say before you get into that, when you do introduce the defense, are you having your defense do different things to prepare your offense? So different things versus ball screen or different types of looks defensively?
Yep. So we'll do for every practice before we ever go any live, like there's a segment 10, 15 minutes where we're just going 5-on-0 and we have a different zone offense versus man offense, but we'll incorporate all those things even into the 5-on-0 situation. And maybe if we know what another team has done to us in the past defensively, we'll start to incorporate some of that stuff as well. And then when we do bring on the defense, the hope is that we are just in a comfortable routine that we can get to the spots on the floor that we like to play from. And yeah, of course, you know, everybody's going to play the ball screens a little bit differently, or teams are going to at times just put somebody in the middle of the lane that's almost guarding nobody. And once we bring in that defense, I just feel a lot more confident that with all the 5-on-0 stuff that we've done and the creativeness that you have to be creative if you're running 5-on-0 stuff. Right? Like if you're just a robot out there in 5-on-0 stuff with how we're playing and the pace that we're playing, it's really not going to work. So getting them comfortable just moving and trying to be creative 5-on-0, then all of a sudden when we do bring the defense in, regardless of what they're doing, we're just ready to go. And we're just trying to play with an aggression that we're hopefully going to put the defense on their heels.
Well, I'm a big proponent of this, coach, and if you don't know my stuff, but one thing that I want you to think about maybe is just adding one defender, making it 5-on-1. Mm-hmm. Or adding two mm-hmm. defenders, making it 5-on-2 with those players having freedom, creates more game-like decisions and game-like passes and game-like pace to what you do in terms of the 5-on-0. And it's a natural progression from there in terms of trying to accomplish what you're talking about, which is developing creativity too. So it's an interesting thing, and I'd love for you to experiment with it and get back to me in terms of kind of what you might think about that. But anyways, this other kind of question lingers there, and this I think is really cool is, so you have young kids, or young, just one, or you have two?
I have one little girl who's two.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. So as she gets older and she starts to play basketball, how early can we start this system with her? Because I think at the youth level, obviously what we're talking about beyond maybe defining specifically, you know, the preferred playmaker as early so that we don't label a player maybe, but what part of the system would work at the youth level?
Oh my goodness. I remember my dad, he would have our AAU team testing out any new little gimmicks that he had in like sixth, seventh and eighth grade.
Okay. That early. And yeah. Which is great. Now, were you guys shooting threes at that age?
Yeah, we were, he had a shooting threes. I remember one game in particular. I don't even know how he came up with this, but he had said to us, maybe we were in seventh or eighth grade at the time. And he had said to us, hey, you know what? We have 11 guys on the team here. If all 11 guys make a 3-point shot in this game, then we're going to McDonald's. And as a seventh grader, there was nothing that we all would have loved more than to go to McDonald's. And so not even realizing it at the time, like once somebody had made a 3-point shot, then all of the energy was focused on that player, then deferring and screening and rebounding and really working to get somebody else a 3-point shot, you know, and looking back on it, as crazy as it might sound, like there was something to be said about that, about the team atmosphere that it created for us, and that it took the pressure off of winning or losing. It focused on every player kind of having to adjust their role. And that once you hit a three, like your primary concern was, hey, I need my teammate to get involved now. And how am I going to adjust my role on the court? You know, I'm not thinking about this as a seventh grader. I'm thinking about it now. Like, how am I going to adjust my role and just kind of instinctively what's going to have to be done to get this other player a shot now?
But I think that's brilliant. And that comes back to what you're trying to do, which is positively impact the team dynamic. And you think about youth sport, how many kids don't get to play offense? If you're talking about the ages that you're talking about, I watch so many teams where none of those kids beyond say two or three get to play offense. And this is, I believe, where there's a key missing part to all of youth sport, but where this system potentially can be obviously even more beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Like especially at that age where it's kind of a positionless, I mean, yeah, you have your point guard that's bringing the ball down the floor, but our style is kind of a positionless way to play the game. And I think maybe less so now, but definitely when we were growing up, like, and what I thought that my old man was ahead of the curve on was not limiting the biggest player to just sticking him inside. And and you don't know how much somebody's going to grow or if somebody's going to fall in love with the sport or exactly how they're going to develop, but just getting everybody to play all different positions. And I think you're seeing that more and more. And that's why the game of basketball in general has just taken off. Like, there are now 7-footers that are just totally comfortable shooting from the 3-point line and maybe don't even know how to post up at this point. And I think that is actually great for the game as the diversified skill sets, and you're just getting bigger guys that are comfortable playing on the perimeter. I know that it's made it easier for us to recruit to in some senses because there are bigger players that like to spot up and we try to take advantage of that. But I think that right there, the positionless style is what can greatly impact younger teams.
Oh, I agree. And I think it's great. And the other part that goes with that is, so do you find your players over their 4 years, do they get better individually in this system? Because I think another part that kind of people sometimes question is how, and if you go back to someone running this at the high school level, are you preparing players for their next level? Are they improving, even if we're not worried about their next level? Are they improving as players individually? Do you find that happens?
Yeah, I find that our guys they're getting more comfortable making decisions at a quick speed. You know, and because of the way that we play, again, there are going to be a ton of mistakes made often early on, especially with our first-year players. They're not used to playing at that speed. They're not used to making decisions at that speed. And then you combine that with a bump up in physicality and athleticism and everything else. But having to make quick decisions, we tell our guys, hey, you should never be catching and holding the basketball for more than a 1,001 count. Like something needs to be happening right away. And so trying to get guys just that is the biggest area of development for us, is just the speed with which guys can make decisions and the comfort level in making decisions at a quick speed.
That's great. And the other part we've talked about a little bit is
the shot selection concept. And does the type of shot, or what's considered a bad shot or a good shot in your system, does it change by those difference, like pre 12 seconds versus after 12 seconds of the shot clock? Do you define it differently?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I generally try not to spend that much time talking about anything that's going to happen after 12 seconds, because I don't really want us to get used to taking shots after 12 seconds. And so that's usually a conversation with our preferred playmaker. And I guess actually more so with, maybe it's with everybody too, about, hey, you know, once you've gotten to there, we just need to get a shot up. And yeah, the shot selection might go out the window somewhat. I mean, it's not like we're going to take a lot of pull-up mid-range jump shots ever. We would still like it to be a 3-point shot. But I think everybody on the floor knows that, hey, you know what? At this point, I'm not the preferred playmaker. I might even be fourth in the pecking order in terms of the 5 guys on the floor from the arc. But we need to get a shot up so that we can get back to running up and down. And that's basically how we try to talk about that.
Yeah, it's great. And you talked about Dean Oliver. So does he support this system? Like, from his standpoint, do the 4 factors generally play out in your favor? Like, is this something that he would endorse?
You know what? That's a great question. He and I are very, very good friends. I think more than anything, he found it to be extremely interesting and wanted to figure out why there were certain things about the way that we play. You know, I mean, just to give you an example, other teams this past year, they shot 55, 56% from the floor against us. And why are we even able to be at all competitive when we have the worst field goal percentage defense in the entire country? Or, you know, why just the turnovers? And so I think him getting a closer look, I guess I can't really speak for him in terms of what he's a proponent for. He was always incredibly supportive for me, and he and I talk frequently now, but you know, he was always very open to really any ideas and any tweaks or experiments that we wanted to put out there. And I think that from his perspective, he just kind of wanted to see it. And
yeah, well, I think that's a curiosity that I imagine he would have, and that's why I kind of asked it. But yeah, no, it is fascinating. I mean, again, everything for you, all your stats are adjusted by pace. So that would be the other part that goes with it. And, you know, I see, have you done those analytics too, in terms of your field goal percentage defense adjusted for pace?
I have not looked at that specifically. One statistic that I would say I took the most out of when I was in the G League was the percentage that we shot from the 3-point line off of inside out 3-point shots versus off the dribble or lateral pass threes. And you know, that we were like 8 percentage points higher. And we tracked it for individual players. And there were some guys, David Stockton was one of them, John Stockton's son. David Stockton played at Gonzaga and played with me for both years in the D-League. He was one of the few players that was actually just as good of a shooter off of a lateral pass three or a swing around the arc as he was off an inside out three. But in general, all the other players were just so much better off of these inside out threes. And so, you know, that's something that we've started tracking at Grinnell, and we're trying to build up some data to make it a little bit bigger sample size to see exactly how much of a difference does that make.
Well, I love that. And I hope at some point you'll share that. But, you know, the other part for me is if there's an understanding, because I think there's a big fear too about early 3-point shots being not the best shot you can get. But I think over certainly what we're learning about the game of basketball, in some ways it's the best shot you can get because it's traditionally open. So, you know, the fear over the pace and different things that you're talking about is really unique. And I don't know, did you chart that type of stuff in early three versus say a three in the first 6 seconds versus the next 6 seconds? I don't know. I broke it down, but was that part of charting in any way?
Sounds like it's going to be something that we're going to be charting moving forward.
Well, I love that. And I love that. It fascinates me. And I know one of the reasons that I was very interested in your dad's philosophy years ago when we had him to the University of Windsor for a coaching clinic was just, again, it counters so many cultural norms in coaching. And in some ways, it removes so many fears in coaching too. And I think I took it without running the system exactly the way we ran it. I think the part I took away the most was this concept of giving my players freedom to be able to shoot open shots when they get open, because it's really hard to get open shots. And it's got to be fun. It's got to be fun for you as a coach. It's got to be fun for your players. So it's just tremendous, tremendous stuff. So, Coach, anything you want to leave us with in terms of thinking about this system and everything that you do?
We're having a blast out here. Have the support of our administration to have my old man kind of pave the way with what we're doing, and to be able to continue to tweak and experiment. I mean, it's just like the dream job for me, you know, that we can have fun with a group of guys that are certainly at Grinnell for academic reasons and also wanting to play basketball. And, you know, none of them or very few of them will play basketball after college other than in a rec league. And just to be able to give the guys on the team something positive to talk about. It's just a joy.
Well, tremendous. And I encourage coaches, if they haven't had a chance yet, to check out. I know there's a number of DVDs and products out there to be able to learn more about your system. But even if they have access to Synergy, to be able to watch some of your games and, you know, to be able to follow along with what you guys do, because it's tremendous. You and your father have made a huge impact on the basketball world. So thanks for taking the time to be on the Basketball Podcast with us, Coach.
Thank you very much for having me.
Basketball Immersion is one-stop shopping for video learning to stimulate your basketball coaching using evidence-based practices. Watch hundreds of videos covering BDT shooting, zero-second skill training, how we teach using small-sided games and a games approach to coaching, as well as team concepts and systems like trail trap, flow offense, two-sided fast break, and much, much more. NCAA, NBA, pro, high school, and youth coaches are amongst the thousands of coaches who are a part of our community. Go to basketballimmersion.com today to stimulate your basketball coaching.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.